This is The Spark. I'm Martha Woodruff. If you're a longtime bookstore browser, you may have noticed there are fewer and fewer bookstores around in which to browse. Charlottesville's Paul Cohen opened Heartwood Books on Elliewood Avenue back in the halcyon bookstore business days of the 1970s. And he's still working away at the book business in the far less halcyon book business days of 2012.
I went to Georgetown, and after a year or so, my roommate got a part-time job at a bookstore, and then he got me a part-time job at a bookstore, and then I dropped out of college in 1969 because a lot of things were going on, and I got a full-time job in a bookstore, and I've been in the book business ever since. I started in new books for about 3 years, and then I started a used bookshop in Washington. And after about 18 months, I sold that, wanting to move out to the country, which I did, and moved up to Madison County, Virginia, and later Greene County, and later Albemarle, and finally the city of Charlottesville. And in 1975, needing a job, I started a used bookstore near the University of Virginia.
Why bookshops for you?
I don't really know the answer to that, except that when I got a job in one, I was very good at it. I could remember titles. I could remember where we put the book. I could remember what the books looked like. I could remember what somebody asked for the week before. And, sometimes I think you do get in a career that may just be completely accidental. And I think this, in a way, was completely accidental.
Hello. I can relate to that. There's a difference between working in a bookstore and starting a bookstore, particularly a used bookstore. Why that particular leap?
Well, I actually like new books. I mean, when I worked in new books, I really liked new books. There's an excitement to it. A new book is coming out. You can order more copies of it. If you sell 10, you can get 10 more. But used books requires very little capital to start, and I had very little capital. I started the shop for, basically on my savings, which was probably something like $1,500 when I first got going, and eventually borrowed some money for various expansion. But basically, you can run a used bookshop. You can start a used bookshop for very little money, and that's really why I'm in the used book business.
Freedom's just another word for nothing left to lose. Nothing ain't worth nothing, but it's free.
Tell me about the early days of Heartwood. Who worked there? What'd you do? What customers were like? And what Elliewood Avenue was like?
Well, in looking around Charlottesville in 1975 for a place to start a shop, Elliewood had a certain appeal. It had a kind of a counterculture feel to it. It was tree-covered. It had a vegetarian restaurant, a bike shop. So since I was at the time kind of in that world, it seemed like the perfect place to start a bookshop. And, of course, what I really need for customers are people with a certain amount of money, a certain amount of time, and a certain level of education. And so being right near the university, kind of enabled me to get all that at once. And it was a small operation. The rent, I think, at the time was about $250 a month or something like that. So it's about 10 times that now. But, we paid the rent. We paid ourselves what we could, and it grew. I started upstairs at number 9 Elliewood with two rooms, and eventually I had a little side venture up there as well where I was part owner of a shop called Dangerous Visions Books, which did mysteries and science fiction. And eventually I rented most of the upstairs, or maybe all the upstairs, I don't remember, and in 1977 or 78, there was a shop below us called the Golden Temple Emporium, which was run by American Sikhs, one of whom is still in town and still in the jewelry business, but no longer in the Sikh business. And when he moved out, we moved downstairs.
You want to mention names?
At number 9 Elliewood. Should I mention it?
Sure.
Well, Peter Rhines of Rhines Jewelers was the man who ran the Golden Temple Emporium at the time. And so we took over his space. And, you know, that doubled our business. And we eventually moved back upstairs and took over most of the upstairs. So at one point, I had the first and second floor of number 9. And then in 1980, Fine Print Books at number 5 Elliewood went out of business. It was a much bigger space. And so we took that. And I kept the downstairs at number 9. For a separate rare and collector's shop.
All right. Let's stop right there for a minute. Fine Prints was, I can't remember Fine Prints. Was it a new bookshop?
Fine Print was a new bookshop.
Okay.
They did new books. They did some textbooks. And they started in a building that was torn down to build the Marriott Hotel down on West Main Street. And then they moved up to Elliewood. They were there for just a few years.
And then they went out of business.
They went out of business.
In 1980.
Around 1980, yeah.
Okay, was it competition? What do you think?
Well, I think a direct result of the university expanding their commercial presence. The university, the whole time I've been there, has expanded more and more into commercial businesses. They now have a bookstore they recently expanded, and in the process they actually reduced the amount of space that was devoted to books. And they now have women's clothing and makeup and all sorts of stuff, and there seems to be no limit to what they're. They've even opened a bagel shop, and whatever does well at the corner, the commercial district that I'm in, they seem to pick up on and try to do it themselves.
The university,
yeah. So I think there was a direct result of the initial expansion of the university bookstore and Fine Print Books going out of business, and eventually University Bookstore and Anderson Brothers, who were the descendants of the original bookshop that Thomas Jefferson asked to come to the university, Thomas Jefferson having privatized the book business, basically. Eventually, University Books and Anderson Brothers also went out of business. And I think that's, you know, the result of the university running its own first book business and later mini mall business.
And you're still standing.
I'm still there. I'm not sure I'm standing anymore.
Let's go back to 1980. Fine Prints goes out of business. And Heartwood does what?
Well, we move into a larger space, a more prominent space, and business was very good for the next approximately 20 years. And then we start the downward side of the arc, which is the initial sort of shock of Amazon and the online booksellers that began to develop really strongly in the late 90s.
Mm-hmm.
And our business began to decline. And so our business has declined each year since 2000. And we've cut back space. We've cut back staff. We used to have 4 full-time people and a bunch of part-time people, and now we basically have 2 full-time people and a couple of very part-time people. We've cut back space at number 9 where we had the antiquarian shop, and for the last several years, it's been very hard to make any money at all. This is the state of bookstores today.
The remaining business, what is it?
Well, I mean, what we do is pretty much what we have done the whole time. The shop at number 5 Elliewood, which is the large shop, has a mixture of used books and remainder books, which are new copies. They've never been used. They're publishers overstock, and we choose them from among the thousands and thousands of offerings that we get. And we choose them the type of books we think appeal to, you know, the broad community that exists around the university, and that is to say the students, the faculty, the staff, the visitors, the parents. We still do well with that. I mean, people that come in the shop like the shop. They buy things. It's just that fewer and fewer people seem to come in the shop. And when we would have a pretty day in the spring in the past and the shop would be full of people, now we have a pretty day in the spring and the street is full of people, but the shop is not.
And is this because of, actually, I mean that to be a question.
I think it's directly the result of the rise of computers. And I think the result, that has a lot of different effects on
Sounds
people.
Sounds like a science fiction.
It does. The computers that ate books.
Yeah.
And it, to some extent, they're destroying books, and to some extent, they're providing books, and both are happening now. I think the average person spends an awful lot of time on computers that they didn't spend before, and that can be very productive time, or it can be very unproductive time. It can be Facebook. It can be video games. It can be research on medieval history. But to some extent, that time takes up time that would have been spent reading books. The other thing is books are so readily available on the Internet. There's almost no titles that you can't immediately find at some price or another, even out-of-print titles. And so people have this notion that they can always get the book. They don't need to buy the book that they might need in the future. So a history graduate student no longer buys the standard biography of Benjamin Franklin, thinking they may need it sometime in the future. Now they think, well, I can always get it when I need it. And so that cuts out the actual purchasing of books. And then, of course, people do buy books on the Internet, and it's convenient, and the books can be shipped right to their office or home, and it saves them time and trouble.
I'm asking you, as a person who's been in the book biz for a long time, and I have often wondered if reading whole books is becoming irrelevant to how we go about our business.
Well, if we don't read whole books, and if we don't do sustained, uninterrupted reading of serious books or serious anything, we're really not going to learn. And so if it is true that sustained reading of books is irrelevant in some fashion, that does not bode well for an educated populace. The idea that Google has all the answers is sort of true, but unless you're already educated, you can't pick the correct answer out from the many answers that it gives you. And so I do have a concern that the overall emphasis on technology and education, which seems to be heavily pushed by the kind of business and political side of the world, is really bad for education. And I think the idea that every child must have a laptop and that every child needs to be on computers at a very early age is totally false and very damaging to education.
I'm just going to let that statement sit unchallenged and let people think about it.
Butterfly in the sky, I can go twice as high. Take a look, it's in a book, a reading rainbow. I can go anywhere. Friends to know and ways to grow, a reading rainbow. I can be anything.
Back before the break, we were talking with Charlottesville's Paul Collins about the decades he spent owning and running Heartwood Books on Elliewood Avenue. Now we're going to move on to talking about antiquarian books. I have old books aplenty at my house. No idea whether they're very ordinary or very extraordinary. How on earth did you first get into and then learn about antiquarian books?
Well, back in about 1970 or so, I took over the job of liquidating antiquarian books that were left over from the antiquarian department at the new bookstore where I worked in Georgetown. And at the time that I took it over, at the age of about 21 or 20, I didn't know anything about them, nor did anyone else who worked there. They had been out in the warehouse for years. So I was given a couple of reference books and told to put prices on these books and try to sell them, and I did. And a couple of dealers, one of whom was Larry McMurtry, the well-known writer, but who was also a book dealer, a couple of dealers and a couple of collectors began to come around to see what I put out and what price I put it out at. And they would snap up certain books and other books they wouldn't buy at all. So I began to learn that, you know, some books I was underpricing and some books evidently I was either overpricing or there was no demand for it. But the owner of the shop was thrilled because I was hauling boxes out of a warehouse and producing money. And he wasn't particularly concerned, and I wasn't necessarily telling him that I had made some horrible mistake. I would just tell him, oh, we sold $100 worth of books today. And so I did have a start that enabled me to make mistakes and not lose money. And then when you get into the used book business, you're always going to be, to some extent, in the rare book business, because every time you go to someone's house or every time you go to some yard sale to look at books, there may be a collector's item there of some sort, and you begin to study and learn to recognize them. And that's a hard process. It's never over. Taste in collecting shifts. You learn from your mistakes, except that in many cases, your biggest mistakes, you never have an opportunity with that same book again because it truly was rare. And if you undersell it, then you know, you undersell it and you're not going to see another one. Sometimes, you know, you learn something sold quickly and you can find another. But a lot of times something sells quickly and you realize, uh-oh.
Do you have a mistake that you still gnash your teeth about?
Well, I mean, I've made a lot of mistakes, but one was I had a very interesting book about Yosemite with early tipped-in photographs.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time, the book seemed to sell for the sales records that I could find on it indicated it sold for about $1,500, and this was sometime in the late 70s. And I sold it to somebody thinking I was smart for $2,500, but I'm completely missed because I'm not in New York City, the fact that old photo books were climbing in price dramatically. And he simply put it at a New York auction and sold it for $20,000. And when I actually got the auction catalog, I thought, oh, my goodness. And this was a time when I could, you know, my car was only worth $1,000. So, you know, it really stung. I thought, boy, if I made a mistake, you know.
It's only fair to ask you, what is the greatest find you've ever had?
Well, that's one of them right there. But,
yeah.
there's an American author named Malcolm Lowry, and one time I sold an entire archive of his documents for...
Here I go. Okay.
For tens of thousands of dollars. A man brought in a pamphlet that had been thrown away by the Library of Congress, and I sold for $7,500 on consignment from him. And we've sold usually on consignment or usually where I may be part owner of something, substantial collections of Jefferson books. I was involved in handling a collection that included all the early editions of Jefferson's Notes on Virginia. And so there have been, you know, a lot of significant things that have moved through, and I will make a percentage on them or a finder's fee, or perhaps I will buy them outright and sell them. So,
okay. We left you in our historical thing in the rare books as a 21-year-old with a couple of dusty reference books at a warehouse. And now we have you as a participant in dealing with Jeffersonian papers. Did you get from there to here just by experience, hunting and pecking?
Yeah, basically. I mean, there's substantial reference books available, and I have hundreds of them, thousands of them, actually, that are used in identifying what's a first edition and establishing what's important about that first edition. I have runs of various dealer catalogs. I have runs of auction catalogs. The book auction records are now available both online and on a subscription basis. So that's changed somewhat. And now, of course, there's, you know, all sorts of things listed online, which can be very misleading unless you know who the dealer is and if you know that they've done their work. But it's a cumulative knowledge of both books and book prices and also of who buys books. And so you get to know other dealers who may specialize in a certain area. You get to know librarians and curators who buy for their collections. You get to know, to some extent, private collectors who have specific interests. And that enables you to find something really good and sell it, even though it may not really appear in your shop at any point. It moves through your hands in some way or another. But over the years, I've done antiquarian book fairs in Boston and Washington and other cities. We used to issue a mail-out catalog to people with listing rare books. That's mostly shifted to the internet now. But we've done a lot of things that, you know, are essentially outreach to try to sell people books and try to buy books from people.
I was watching a program on the History Channel with my husband, and this guy came on, and it said, Joe Smith, expert. And we loved that. It didn't say expert in what. He was just an expert. So, Paul Collins, are you an expert?
I would say that I am an expert in running a general used and rare bookshop in near a university.
All right. What's your own relationship with books like now?
Well, I like books, and if I had my druthers, I would spend much of the day sitting and reading them rather than hauling them around in boxes. I've always got stacks and stacks of books around the house that I haven't read. I mean, my collection consists mostly of books that I haven't read, because if I read them, I bring them back to the shop. I'm a minor book collector. I collect certain types of early 19th century American printing and binding that just really appeal to me. They're not necessarily of any great value.
Printing and binding, such as?
Well, in the 1840s, roughly, the American book binding, leather binding, and cloth binding shifted from being either plain or, if it was decorated, it was uncommon to be decorated because it costs a lot of money to hand decorate. So when you have a leather binding and it has a lot of gilt tooling on it, in the old days, somebody had to pick up a tool and do each little flower and each little dot, and they would roll lines out and this type of thing. And it became mechanized sometime in the maybe late 1830s, 1840s, and really flowered so that eventually you would simply develop a single large essentially printing plate, and you would print the front of the book with all this decoration and gold. So things became very fancy. So they went from a kind of a period that only well-to-do people could get really fancy books into a period where, you know, your average upper-middle-class person could buy what now appeared to be a very fancy book. And that period intrigues me. It has a certain kind of a folk art look to it.
The pre-mechanized?
No, the beginning. The changeover.
And how do you recognize it? Just by date, or can you?
Well, you
tell
just recognize it, and that's about all I can tell you. But, I mean, if you look at enough of these things over the years, and I've looked at, you know, millions of books, you know, you begin to be able to pretty much tell the date of a book, or roughly the date of a book, by its appearance if it's in the original binding. And I kind of like the very sort of American notion that we've invented a way to decorate the book, and by God, we are going to decorate the heck out of it. And so these books have, you know, gilt edges and fancy lithograph plates in them and different color paper and, you know, gold all over the cover. And you know, it's really just an example of kind of getting carried away with things.
Which we Americans do, with new any kind of new technology.
Yeah.
Woohoo!
New technology.
Let's go. I want to ask you about one last area of your vast experience, which is the Virginia Festival of the Book. You were there at the beginning.
Yeah, in a way, you could say the Virginia Festival started in my bookshop, because Cal Otto, who was a retired businessman with an interest in printing and publishing, came in the shop one day and said, we need to get a festival, a book festival going in Charlottesville. And he had, this was prompted partly by discussions he had had with other people and partly by the fact that there was a New York street book fair that had been getting some publicity that week. And I said to him, oh, I know just how we can do it. And the reason I knew just how we could do it was that A couple of years earlier, there had been a poetry festival in Charlottesville run in honor of the poet Stanley Kunitz. And they had had poets reading all over town. So they had a poet reading in the courthouse. They had a poet reading at a restaurant. They had a poet reading at a church. And so I immediately thought of this structure, and I had a background also in local community theater. So I had a lot of community contacts in various ways. And I simply thought, well, this is easily done. There are many, many authors in Charlottesville. We can just, you know, call them up. I knew most of them, and get them to do something, and we can scatter it all over town. And in addition to that, we can get local organizations to sponsor programs. So if there's an organization, a gardening organization, they can get a gardening author. And that's really the kind of structure of it that we started with. And Tom Dowd from the Division of Continuing Education was the kind of the third person in the group to get things going. And then
what year was this?
I don't remember.
Well, approximately.
I have no idea. We're at, what, the 18th festival or the 17th or something.
Okay.
I don't know. I don't remember years very well, so I don't know the
year. All right. A long time ago.
So we met with Terry Bellinger, who was running the Rare Book School, and he immediately committed, I think, $1,000 a year for this thing. And the local Friends of the Library group at the Jefferson Madison Regional Library committed money. The president's office at the university under John Casteen committed money and also assigned us an assistant provost to make sure that we didn't somehow destroy the credit of the university. And she was great because she had every contact available in the university. She was great, and she just wanted it not to turn out to be like the film festival, which at the time was struggling and costing the university money. And then, of course, we met with the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities, which is the parent organization for the Festival of the Book and what has really made it go over the years. And the foundation raises money all year in various ways and then loses it on the Festival of the Book. And almost everybody is happy with that result.
And what was your involvement like through the years?
Well, for the first few years, I was on the phone multiple times every day for 6 months with whoever was actually doing much of the work. I talked to Cal every day. I talked to the early, what we call it, coordinators, the job that Nancy Damon now has. Initially, were part-time people, and they often did not know the town and did not know what we had done last year and did not know who authors were and did not know how big a room you needed for one author versus another author. So literally, I was on a phone from the shop every day, you know, with many phone calls for probably 6 months of the year. I mean, I spent probably thousands of hours on it each year for the first several years. And then I tapered off, and the foundation tapered on, and it's now run, you know, pretty much as a year-round presence, and a staff at the foundation that jumps in as the festival takes place, and practically everybody out here does something about the festival. And the you know, it has a year-round coordinator in Nancy Damon. And so as long as the money can be raised and as long as the foundation and the board of the foundation are willing to lose money every year, it's a great event, and thousands of people, tens of thousands of people attend events, and they're almost all free, and we've had all sorts of important authors, and it keeps people talking.
Is there anything book-wise or otherwise on your bucket list? Thou and I are getting up there. Anything that you haven't done that you'd like to do?
Well, there's always the Gutenberg Bible out there someplace. But other than that, not particularly. I mean, I've enjoyed what I've done. Because anytime anybody runs a small business, it's a hassle. It's a huge hassle with things like healthcare. It's enormously expensive for small business people, and I was hoping something was going to be done about that, and that would be a real help to me if that went through, and to all small business people who have fewer than 25 employees. But there's that, you know, that kind of constant financial pressure. You've got to pay the rent. So it would be great if I could not have that constant financial pressure. It would be great if I could have a little more time off. It would be great if I could do more reading. But, you know, we don't have the Morgan Library in Charlottesville or something, so I can't really aspire to, you know, hanging out and looking at medieval manuscripts.
Sometimes I think about leaving, they're a little bumming around. Throw my bills out the window, catch me a train to another town. Gotta go back working. Might drink a little beer at a tavern, sing a little bit of them working man blues. This song was a working man.